Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week we have Jackson Wilkinson to join us, who's works at Project Beacon, which does COVID testing here in Massachusetts and has a long history in Django. Hi, Jackson.
Hey, guys. Good to be with you.
Hello, Jackson. Thank you for coming on.
So I think we first met with Django Boston because PathAI, which is a pathology Django company, was hosting the meetups and you were in charge of that space. So nice to see you virtually.
Good to see you virtually. Yeah, it's one of those weird situations where we actually met in person first in software, right, as opposed to, you know, corresponding online first. And now here we are, right, in COVID times and it's mandatorily virtual. So, you know, funny how things get mirrored up.
But we live near one another in Boston area, and I saw you at a playground, didn't get a chance to say hi. And it got me thinking, oh yeah, what, I wonder what he's up to. And turns out you're deeply involved with Project Beacon, which we'll talk about, among other things. But maybe what's Project Beacon, right? That's the most timely thing. And then I'd love to get your backstory of getting into Django.
Sure. Yeah. So Project Beacon, I've been with since late June of 2020. And it's a really interesting organization. It was started in the spring, funded partially by GV, formerly known as Google Ventures, and F Prime, which is sort of a similar venture arm for Fidelity, as well as the Broad Institute, which is a major genetics and genomics lab affiliated with Harvard and MIT. The three of them got together in the spring and said, we need to increase the capacity and availability of testing in Massachusetts here in our home neck of the woods. And they started Project Beacon, which is not technically a nonprofit. We didn't file the paperwork, but we're chartered to not make a profit and basically do everything we can to drive down the cost of testing in this area. And so, you know, we basically at this point do a handful of different things. But early on, my mandate coming in as chief technology officer was to figure out how to duct tape together a bunch of vendors in the right way to start COVID testing programs. And we figured out that that was going to be a really bad experience for everybody. And we needed to become a software company, which is not what we expected to do.
And, oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I thought that was, you know, because they, you know, you have a software background. I thought that was...
Well, it was really, you know, the thought was there's enough software out there that we should be able to sort of piece it all together. And we need, you know, one or two or three software people to make that happen. And right, it was just not going to be able to do it. Think again about the thesis of driving down the cost of testing. We don't own the lab, so there's a lab price that we kind of can't control. There are all the vendors that are associated with swabs and tubes and all the other things that go into it, and we can't control those either. But there is the human cost of testing and the efficiency of having somebody who's there and staffing a site and puts a swab in your nose and collects it and brings it to the lab and so on. And we thought that technology could drive down the amount of time that it took people to test you, and that could drive down the cost. And so we now operate six large high-capacity regional testing sites here in Massachusetts, each of which do, you know, thousands of tests a day for free, paid for by the state. But in the background, we are driving the cost down by making it the type of experience where you get from check-in to check-out in 3 to 5 minutes. You pre-register online. Nobody needs to do data entry and make errors at the site. You show up with your QR code. They scan the QR code. You get a swab in your nose. You head off and you get results in less than 24 hours, all, you know, in an automated fashion. So there are sort of no data error issues along the way. And as a result, the cost of testing in Massachusetts, the cost of an individual test has gone from over $100 to, you know, generally speaking, you can pay $50 or $60 now, but we charge $26.50 in some of our programs for a PCR test with 24-hour results, and that drives everybody else to lower their prices as well. And we're now, you know, pretty much the state with the most robust testing infrastructure in the U.S., and we've been doing testing elsewhere, and we also do testing in other ways, like antigen testing and this cool technology called pooled testing, where
My school is starting that this week or next week.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure your school system uses Project Beacon for
oh yeah, the test
part
of
the
testing site is right there. So I'm in Brookline, which is just outside of Boston. So they've been using it. I've gone to with my family, the Revere state testing, the mm-hmm. Framingham one. We probably don't need to get into what a disaster testing has been, but it's been everywhere I've seen a solution, it's been Project Beacon.
Can I drag you back up a sec, Jackson? What's the pool testing? Yeah. Like, what is that? That sounds really cool.
Pool testing, it is really cool. It's so let's assume that a COVID test costs $25, at its cheapest for one person. But what if we could put 10 people's swabs into the same tube? If that tube comes back negative, then you know all 10 of those people are negative. And suddenly, rather than costing $25 a person, it costs $2.50 a person.
Okay.
That's... So we do this for schools. You don't want to do it in a place where there's lots of COVID.
Yeah.
But if you have high confidence that very few people in an organization, like an employer or a school or a college, are likely to have COVID, then it's a great way to do sort of weekly surveillance testing. And so we do that in Massachusetts for hundreds of schools now, and it's $3 per person per test.
That's amazing. I mean, you've talked a lot about the price, but the thing that keeps coming into my mind as you're talking about bringing down the price is that, of course, you're increasing the capacity to do the testing as
exactly.
well. And that strikes me as, money's kind of fungible, right? They can come up with that, but the ability to get the entire population through a testing program in reasonable time, that's something that we're still coming up with.
And it's an interesting world that we're living in, in these months, since, we have something like 20, 25, 30% of the population here in Massachusetts has gotten a vaccine. And so as we look toward May and June, there's a situation where the vast majority of people, adults perhaps, have gotten a vaccine. Kids won't have been vaccinated mm-hmm. at that point. But if we have robust infrastructure at schools to be able to do pool testing easily, inexpensively, and that exists at wealthy schools, less wealthy schools, et cetera, then we have a really good system in place where we can monitor and make sure that new variants aren't creeping up. And it's a pretty robust look at the state of health here in Massachusetts. So
we're
pretty psyched to have been a part of it.
Yeah, and the point you just made as well about it being available in all schools, not just like the wealthy ones that can afford the testing, like that's important.
That's right.
Yeah, so Carlton, my schools are, my kids go to the public schools here, and next week they're opening it up to grades two and up. So that's partly why they're doing, or that is why they're doing the pool testing to coincide with,
okay,
with that opening up for full time. They've had a hybrid. I mean, every school is doing it a little differently, but my schools have had a hybrid the last few months.
Yeah, same. I'm the next town out in Newton, and we're, I think April 5th, it goes back full time. So
you're looking forward
looking
to that.
Forward
yeah,
to,
I see the little shuffle in the chair there. You're like, you can't wait for that.
So Carlton, I mean, not to make it all about COVID, we want to talk about the tech, but like you're in Spain. Yep. Spain was
we were hit hard at the beginning, and then we had a massive lockdown because it was the initial phase, it was Italy, and then Spain was the next worst affected country, and so they locked down very hard over the before the summer last year, and that worked really well until the summer, and then of course they opened up over the summer, and all the tourists came from all over Europe, and it was a particular genetic variant of COVID. Or of coronavirus, which is detectable all over Europe because it came from Spain, it came from the Costas. It's like, people bought it and it mixed and it took it back home. And so but they've managed to keep the vaccination situation in Europe's not great. They've been a bit slow off the mark. I think the UK and the US and Israel have got off much quicker, and the EU's been slow off the mark. But I think that's part of it is about, the industrial pipeline ramping up to produce the vaccines in the quantities for, the population of the world. So I if we just said a year ago that we're where we are, I don't think you would have complained. I just think, people in Europe are feeling, why have they got it and we haven't? I think that's the thing. But we've had the schools open the whole time. That's the main thing. So we got four, three of them are at school. One's off because there was a case in her class. So she's off now until after Easter, because if a case comes into an aula, they shut down that whole classroom. Sorry, they shut down that classroom. But the schools have been open, and so each of my children have had a week off or 2 weeks off. Celeste, the one who's off now, she's on her third time of being off. But generally speaking, they've been there, and that's been a you know, an absolute blessing, because I don't think I could have taken another 6 months of them not at school. That was just, you know, 2020 was pretty fierce. So anyway, that was all cool. That was cool. Project Beacon. This is Django chat. Does it use Django? Does it?
We do. We are a Python shop for sure. And so, you know, I think when we started this up and decided that we needed to build our own software platform, it was, we knew we would need to do custom stuff. This was not, you know, you couldn't grab off the shelf libraries for COVID testing. You know, that's not the type of thing that exists. So we needed a lot of flexibility, but at the same time, we needed to work quickly. The difference between shipping something 2 weeks earlier might have been thousands of people's tests, right? Like we're sort of racing against the clock in a public health situation. So so in July of 2020, we started kicking this off. And as Will knows, I've spent a lot of time with Django over the course of my career. I'm very familiar with it. In talking to, you know, obviously didn't have time to hire FTEs, full-time folks. And I'm not really sure who would want a full-time role, knowing that as soon as COVID is done, who the heck knows what's going on with your job. You know, I was willing to do that, but yeah, I don't know that everybody is. But you know, so I started talking to an agency that I'm friendly with, because I'm an alum. I it was one of my first jobs after school. I worked at this agency called Viget, which is great. They're historically like a Rails and React shop, but they've done some stuff with Django, and obviously, you know, those two frameworks are, you know, cousins of each other in a lot of ways. And so had a quick conversation with them, said, hey, do you guys think you'd be able to support me? And this might be a 4 week project. This might be a 4 month project. Who the heck knows?
Yeah.
We got to work really quickly. And, you know, by the end of August, we, were getting ourselves into gear and had some early launches, and that, test site in Revere, Massachusetts that Will mentioned earlier, was our first one to open up in terms of high capacity test sites. And we did that in October. And pretty quickly, wow, we were doing, you know, the plurality of public testing in Massachusetts before the end of the year. So it was, you know, a pretty rapid pace. And Django was the key part of it, right? Like we had to build quickly, and we needed to do it in a way that was, where new members of the team could pick it up easily and get a handle on what we were doing. And so it's React on the front end, a GraphQL interface to Django on the back end, and then we hosted on Aptible, which is a hosting provider that's built on AWS. It's kind of like Heroku for healthcare, I guess, is like, okay, one of the easiest ways, nice, to describe it. So sort of a Git and Docker based deploy process.
Okay.
That again, I've been using for years on most projects, and so I'm really familiar with it. So it's really like, what's the hammer in my tool belt, and can I force other people to use those same hammers along the way?
Yeah, so. But I mean, you know, to have a reliable go-to tool chain where you're like, you know, it's this, and when someone comes, you talked about getting a new person on to use the same tools. If you can onboard them, say, look, it's just vanilla this, it's vanilla that. It's, you know, if you need to learn this library, it's just read the README, and that, you know, it's not complicated. It's not, you know, I haven't done anything homebrew.
Right. And you know, we've gotten to the point where it's a pretty hefty and complicated product at this point, but you know, early on we wanted to, you know, just get things moving and be as flexible and fast as we could possibly be. And you know, there are things that are not always perfect about Django, but I think it's a really good Swiss Army knife for a lot of these types of things, and can go a long way in a hurry.
And you talked about people entering their own data and getting their QI coded, so that's all like probably a mobile friendly website with React.
And yeah, it's so it's a responsive web app that so we don't have a native app in any app stores or anything like that. That was sort of a constant question that we got early on, but I'm a pretty big believer in the open web, and you know, this way we can serve anybody who has a modern browser at their disposal, whether it's
probably work, know, on a smart TV or,
exactly, yeah. And we also were translated into seven languages. So that's, you know, something that you don't often have to do for, you know, an early stage product here, but we needed to manage that kind of stuff as well. So accessibility is pretty huge to us. We want to make sure screen readers have, you know, as close to a first-class experience as they possibly can. So all those types of things you have to worry about early on in public health situations.
Yeah, because you've got I can't remember the code, the 503 code, is it, where it's kind of for any sort of government thing, it's legally mandated that it's accessible.
That's true. In this case, this isn't technically a government website, so we don't have those specific types of restrictions, but we would hold ourselves accountable to those types of bars anyway. It's just,
the right thing to do.
We want equity to be a key component of what we offer here. So
fantastic.
You're both married to doctors. So I think that's part of what informs knowledge on these things. I'm really curious to ask. So we've had a number of consultants on. From your side, what was the, you know, so you already knew Viget, but what is that process like? So presumably you said, okay, here's what round one looks like in terms of functionality. Can you talk about on your side of how you interact with them? And then it grows from there. Like you said, you know, we need login, like why GraphQL, for example, like how are those decisions made? I guess, is it all just you saying, hey, I want this, or how much back and forth is there?
There's a lot of back and forth. So I would say it's probably a little bit different from the normal, client vendor relationship in that, every day, you know, at 10:30, AM, we have our stand up and I'm in it. I lead it. And you know, so unlike probably most client relationships in this context, it's very, very hands-on. They're full teammates of mine. We interact that way. But when it comes to, decisions around architecture and tech, I think in the early days, it was often me making a proposal and seeing how that stuck with the team. But GraphQL, for instance, I'm probably more of a GraphQL skeptic than I am like a GraphQL fanboy. And you know, I think that there are really nice things about it. It's really flexible. But at the same time, if I'm, this is how old I am, if I'm looking at like web logs to get a sense of like how certain features are used, it's just a bunch of post requests to GraphQL. Like I can't see anything, right? Like, and so, you know, the ability to track and measure certain things.
Carlton feels that. You're the youngest one on this call, by the way.
But you know, I'm like looking at Nginx logs and I'm like, WTF, what the heck is all this stuff? And you know, where RESTful stuff, you're like, oh, these are the features that are most used, right? Like as a product person and as a sort of exec, you know, GraphQL doesn't make my life easy. But on the other hand, you know, it really came down to speed and being able
upfront is faster.
Right. And since speed was going to win here, it was, hey, we can really iterate on this and expand our scope in this API a lot faster with GraphQL than we'd be able to do with a RESTful framework. And I was like, all right, that's a convincing argument. Let's do it. And I still complain about the measurement and, you know, logging abilities there. But on the whole, it has been, I think, the right decision from sort of a speed and effectiveness front there. So a lot of that was give and take. You know, we sort of had, again, I'm an old man. And so, you know, single page front end frameworks are occasionally tough for me to swallow when it comes to, you know, the challenges of how those get debugged and, you know, not necessarily having a full request associated with each thing that you want to do and so on. There's a double-edged sword to all those things. And so, you know, we have those conversations and ultimately I want the team to be able to do something that they're comfortable and confident in. And sometimes that means I'm going to bend, but other times I need to push the team to take on some things that might be a little uncomfortable for them because either, you know, we need good audit logs of what's going on because this is healthcare and, you know, those types of concerns might ultimately just need to win out. And so it's been a really great collaborative relationship that we've had over these past, you know, 8 months or so that we've been working together. And but it's different from your normal client vendor relationship, and I think at least from my experience, so it's been really great.
How do you test that? I mean, not just the software testing, but, you know, because it's healthcare, like, you know, when I'm in line in Revere, you want it to work. Is there any way to test, to do a dry run, like with the the online and the offline? How does that work?
I mean, certainly early on, we were doing lots of dry runs. We have a great relationship with our lab, which is the Broad Institute. And so, you know, we have a staging environment with them as well. So we can, you know, end to end, throw stuff through this. But, you know, folks are presumably not seeing video most of this, but I have like barcode scanners sitting on my desk and, you know, label printers for all sorts of stuff. So a lot of the folks on our team similarly are sort of equipped with everything that you're going to have at a testing site, which, you know, iPads and MacBook Airs are sort of the hardware that we use there. We have these consumer grade Dymo label printers. We have these, you know, Amazon's bought $60 barcode scanners. Nothing is like special or, you know, super hard to come by. And so we can put them in the hands of, even in this sort of COVID, everybody is remote world, we can, you know, have folks on our team who have access to the same type of equipment that we would use in Revere, the testing site. But then, you know, when a testing site is going up, then we spend, you know, a day in advance, running some folks through it and making sure that everything's working. But in the end, it's just like, keep it as simple as possible so that we have as few things that can go wrong as possible in the end. And most healthcare systems are overcomplicated. And in our case, we only need to do COVID testing. We don't need to do other genetic testing. We don't need to do flu vaccines or anything like that. If you show up, we know what you're getting. You just get into one line and we need to do exactly one thing right. So that gives us a lot of flexibility and a lot of freedom and helps us do a good job of it.
Can I just follow up? There must, though, have been in production errors. So how are you tracking those? And
sure. So we use Sentry to log any exceptions. You know, familiar tools, right?
Sentry's talk about a hammer. Nice, yeah. It's the best thing out there.
Totally, totally. I think it's the clear go-to in any of these events. I think in our case, we don't have things like Google Analytics or anything of that nature on there. We only collect the information that you have shared to register with us. And the only information that you share to register with us is what we are required to report for, you know, like state public health reporting. So we often don't have a lot of information about, you know, the users who are going through our product. And that sometimes makes it a little more tricky than it might be if we had a, you know, if we were a more typical consumer platform that might have a robust set of JavaScript based, you know, tracking tools.
Yeah.
And we don't have those, but we can generally do what we need to do. There are some challenges. One thing, thinking about Europe, Carlton, we obviously focus on Massachusetts and more generally New England, which is the Northeast US. And we do some testing for businesses that want to test their employees. And one of those employers is a multinational corporation that has employees in Europe who occasionally travel to the US and they need to schedule testing. And we found out that if you are on the east side of the UTC line, we have a front end bug that just like totally borks the process for getting an appointment. Like,
good.
And we had no idea that this was the case because none of us were east of the UTC line.
Yeah, you built this in Boston.
Right, totally. And so we started getting these complaints like, do we have restrictions that mean people from the Netherlands are not allowed to book appointments? I'm like, no, we definitely don't have those restrictions. And we're like, it all seems to work for us. And then I change my time zone and suddenly, you know, it all blows up. So time zones are always the thing that bites you, right?
Yeah. Like I've got a do you remember Dastardly and Muttley? I've got a picture of Muttley in my mind now for Russian time zones.
Totally.
I want to ask about Path AI. Do you have more questions, Carlton, on Project Beacon?
No, I mean, that's just amazing. I think we should swing all the way back to the beginning, though, and do, you know, and ask, you know, well, okay, so that's what you're doing right now. But how did you get going, Jackson? Like, how did you get into programming and Django and all those things?
It's your origin story.
Yeah, and then we can work all the way up to Path AI.
Sure. So I was a nerdy kid in a lot of ways, and I think there are pictures of me programming in TI Basic when I was like, I don't know, three, like a sort of ridiculously young age. I think part of me learning to read was reading these Texas Instruments, TI-99/4A, TI Basic books, and like copying them onto the computer and trying to see if they would run, and then making changes to them.
And you're like, Daddy, what does syntax error mean?
And my parents had no idea. They had no clue. My parents were totally non-technical for at least most of my life. And you know, then eventually I had like a couple of neighbors who were mentors who would sort of show me the ropes. And eventually I had, you know, a 4-color CGA display where I could, you know, do more interesting things. And it was pretty amazing and intense. But, and so I was sort of like, my life was baseball and computers for, you know, most of my childhood. And then I kind of put it away in college because it was sort of the dot-com bust, immediately prior to me going to college. And the impression of people who worked in technology at that point was sort of the guy who lives in his parents' basement and spends his days and nights in his underwear and that kind of stuff. And I didn't see myself in that role at the time.
This is pre-COVID.
This is pre-COVID. Yeah. What goes around comes around, right?
Now we're all that. Yeah.
Exactly. But so in college, I was a music and philosophy double major. So entirely non-technical.
Carlton has a PhD in philosophy, so that's why he's nodding.
Nice. I was a fan of David Lewis's modal realism at the time.
Okay,
and all sorts of you know, harebrained ideas. But you know, even through college, I worked in the Network Operations Center and was, you know, building websites for faculty and that kind of thing. So I sort of stayed technical, but I never took a CS class. And then after school, I took a job at a public affairs firm as like an entry level web dev. They're like, you have no credentials. Do you know what you're doing? I was like, I think I know what I'm doing. We'll find out. I was in DC for that, Washington DC, and ended up working on some pretty great sort of public affairs campaigns. After a couple of years, I took a job at Viget and started their user experience program. So I kind of got a little bit more into design at that point. I think I might have just gotten a ding. Let me put myself back on Do Not Disturb. So, after that, I took a job at Viget and started their user experience team. And that sort of took my life a little closer to design. There are a couple funny stories about how I sort of got into that, relating to, you know, at one point at this public affairs firm, our designer had quit, and we got a request to do a site for, you know, I think Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign way back in the day. And we had to come up with some mock-ups, and there was no designer around. And so we were like, what are we going to do? These are due on Monday. It's Friday or something like that.
Crack the knuckles, fire up Photoshop, I'm off.
Exactly. I'm like, hey, guys, you guys keep looking for a contractor. I'm going to see what I can come up with. If we like my stuff, then great. And we ended up using it for the pitch, and I think we won the contract. And so I sort of became like the de facto.
And a star was born.
Designer. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Everyone in the office is like, who knew?
And I mean, looking back at that stuff, I would totally cringe. But, you know, it was nice to be able to sort of start to be a generalist at that point. And at Viget, I started the UX team and maybe wrote a total of 7 lines of code during the entire time I was there. I was definitely a designer. And then I went out west to say I want to be at a startup and went to LinkedIn. And by that time, I was maybe the 250th employee, so it was not a startup anymore. And I didn't know the difference at the time. And it was definitely in growth mode. I worked on a bunch of features that still live to this day. I was, you know, partially responsible for profiles on LinkedIn, homepage, and a lot of, you know, people you may know and things like that, that, still continue to live. So that was a cool experience, but I really wanted to be at a smaller, company. So the Cliffs Notes are, I went to Posterous, which for those of you, who've been around a while, was this rad platform that competed with Tumblr in the early days, but you could, you know, post your blog by email or via the web. And,
I remember that. Yeah.
It was a pretty popular, platform for a while. And, we had a great team, in the mission in San Francisco. So that was a lot of fun. And then I sort of married into healthcare and started a digital health, product called Kinsights, which is a community for parents of kids with rare and complex diseases that, that I was the CEO, and then I demoted myself to CTO, and worked on that for 4 years. And, we sold that to care.com, which brought me to Boston. Care.com is a service best known as a place that you find nannies for your kids. But you can also find housekeepers and, senior care folks. And so I ran product and user experience there. And that was, it was a publicly traded company. So, a lot of different sorts of skills being on the management team at a company like that than at a small, you know, digital health startup. And then that led into Path AI, where I spent 3 years helping build the product design and engineering teams as we tried to implement machine learning and computer vision to help detect diseases like cancer and other sorts of things like that in pathology imagery. So that was a super rewarding time. And I know that there have been folks on the podcast who, who've worked at Path AI as well. So, probably heard a little bit about that in the past. So, but that was a great experience. And I took that right up to COVID times.
Wow. So you've been literally, I mean, like you've been over the whole country, like you've been west, you've been east, you've, you know.
Yeah. I mean, haven't spent a lot of time in the south, at this point.
Just the coast, Carlton. Just the coast.
Well, that is the whole country. No, there's what's in the middle. Boulder. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, wait, can I ask though? I want to ask about so at Django Boston, you gave a talk on a history of Django, which I know you said you threw together, but I found really interesting going through each of the major versions and the features. When did you first see Django? Because you were like really early on the Django train, as I recall.
Yeah, I think my first Django project was during that very first job of mine, which would have been in, you know, 2005, 2006 sort of time frame. So it was pretty early on. It was pre 1.0. You know, the magic removal branch was the big news in Django land. And you know, I had a little bit of Python under my belt and was spending most of my sort of professional day in PHP. And, you know, sort of wanted something that was a little more MVC-ish and was looking around for what to do. And it was like, all right, well, Rails is pretty popular, but, you know, I'd have to sort of learning curve up on Ruby, but there's this Django thing. Let me play with that a little bit. And it, you know, it did what I needed to do for those early projects. And, it just started becoming that hammer in my belt. And fortunately I remember having discussions at the time about this, you know, fly-by-night, nobody's ever heard of it framework. Why would we ever use this on client projects? And, you know, as time went on, that decision sounded a little less crazy over time. So it was it ended up serving me well. So I'm pretty fortunate in that regard.
That's lovely because like 15 years later, like, Django's sort of everyone's like, it's too old now. We couldn't possibly use it now. It's too old. It's boring. It's like, you know, it's, I know it's exactly why you have to use it, but it's a different topic.
Exactly.
So I want to ask about Path AI a little bit because we had Robbie Groden on, but I mean, that was at a, I'm trying to remember, did you switch them over to Django, right? They were on something else when you joined, you were doing wearing a lot of hats, right? You were product and head of engineering.
Yeah,
something like that.
Product design and engineering for most of my time there. As we grew, that sort of shifted. But yeah, there were a lot of hats that were worn. And early on when
but
I joined...
But it wasn't Django, yeah, right?
That's right. It was Java. And we had a couple developers who were focused on the web. Most of the developers on the team, most of the engineers on the team were focused on machine learning, and they were all, you know, very heavily Python based. And, you know, we had the folks who were working on the website of the platform, were not, they were experienced engineers, but they weren't super experienced web developers. And so they weren't, super tied into to the Java frameworks that they were using and weren't super familiar with it. And there were a few sort of infrastructure choices that made it that made most of our use cases a little bit more edge case. And so the documentation was a little more challenging, and you know, whether we were, because we were in Java mode rather than Scala mode, and so most of the documentation sort of assumed that you were operating in Scala, and we weren't. So the documentation was a little sparser, and we would run into these edge and corner cases seemingly all the time. so as the team grew, and as we were making decisions about where we were going to be going and what we wanted the future to look like, it felt attractive to me to be able to have all the engineers at the company have lingua franca and be able to, you know, use Python more broadly and be able to sort of borrow from the work that everybody was doing. And you know, that meant that Django became a, you know, a potential option there. So we had a lot of conversations with the engineering team about directions that we could go. I piloted out Django on a couple of small micro projects to help folks get accustomed to what that would look like and what that infrastructure felt like without having to sort of overhaul the system. But we had a couple of, you know, smaller services, some internal, some external, that were that I just rolled up my sleeves and implemented in Django, and folks were like, "Oh, huh, you can do that pretty easily, and that was pretty fast, and you know, oh, that seems pretty nice." And after, you know, a few weeks of that, or perhaps a few months of that, we decided that it was worth it to sort of deprecate the Java side and start to spin up the Python and Django side. So a lot of Django REST framework, and in that case, it was more of a RESTful API initially than GraphQL. But yeah, as Robbie talked about, you know, it became a pretty robust and pretty large part of what we did there. And we definitely did get some mileage out of allowing people to sort of flex between working on the customer facing product and working on the machine learning platform, which was also in Python. So it was nice to have that sort of commonality across the org and the ability to share some work and some libraries here and there. So,
and I recall you all were very current with Django editions, because Django versions, because this is, we talk about this a lot in the show, you know, in part because you had started early, but I think also just for you, like, as I recall, it's pretty important to you to stay up to date with the latest versions on your projects.
It is. I was afraid you were going to ask me about that, because I'm worse about it right now with Project Beacon than I think I've ever been in my career.
But you're running off master or main. Well, you're running off main.
We're definitely, you know, at Project Beacon, I think we're, I think we're 3.0 somewhere. I'd have to even look. Like, I'm like that disconnected from it right now, mostly because we, you know, don't always have the time to do all the hygiene things that we would totally love to do.
Sure.
But I think a well-run and well-executed product that does have good hygiene does keep up to date on those types of things. They're the obvious reasons, like security patches and bug fixes, but also just that, you know, the features that come along the way are good and useful, and there will be useful improvements. And I'd rather have small projects to get us up to speed and up to date on a regular basis than have the enormous project when you find out that you know, suddenly you're 2 years behind and it's going to take, you know, 3 months of engineering time, all hands on deck at high risk to get up to a more recent version. So, you know, I'm a pretty big believer in that. And we did a pretty good job with at PathAI. And I think we're still okay. It's only an 8 month old platform, so it can't be that terrible. But we're a little further behind than I would like, I think.
Okay, that's good. How do you find it from a hiring perspective? Because I always think, you know, if you're on the latest version, it's much easier sell to a new recruit than, you know, we're on, you know, 1.10.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of the pitch. If we were saying, yeah, that we're in the 1.x series, or hey, we're still crapping along on 1.8, that was at one point an LTS version, maybe. You know, that would be a tough situation. And I've seen at other companies that just be a slog and be really challenging. And so, you know, hiring, it's an important component. Security and compliance, I think it's an important component. On one hand, you think of compliance as like pinning a version and having something reliable and few changes, but it just exposes you to every vulnerability that comes across, and, you know, makes it a much bigger decision process. So, but yeah, engineers are generally happy when they can go and hit latest in the docs and, you know, actually use them. So it's good to be in that position.
I find your compliance point is a good one. Cause I always struggle with how a company can justify saying, you know, we're using a version of software which has been declared end of life by the people who maintain it. Like, from a liability perspective, you know, if there was some bug that happened because you hadn't patched a version and then you got sued for that, and you wouldn't have a leg to stand on because there's no reason to be on that software.
Well, you can hire Red Hat now. They'll handle your Python 2 for you.
Done. All done.
To your point, though, on versions, I think for people who are interviewing at places, that's one of the best questions to ask. No matter what they say, just say, what version of Django are you on if you're hiring for Django? That tells you what you need to know. They can talk all they want. If they're on 1.5, it tells you.
It definitely tells you something. Probably.
Yeah, it doesn't tell you everything, good. But it's a pretty good tell. I mean, and partly because you were hosting at PathAI, I was hosting the Django Boston, I was surprised that the company was so up to date, because it is unusual, because it is hard and it requires a deep commitment at the top to stay on it.
Right,
it's a better experience as an engineer.
It's hard to justify if you're sort of breaking it out, like as an exec saying, like, yeah, we spend, yeah, I don't know, whatever, 5% of our, you know, time on, you know, upgrading libraries or something like that. That doesn't sound really great, but if you make it a seamless process and you do it so that there are very, you know, few changes that need to happen along the way because you're constantly up to date, then nobody notices and you get all those positive advantages as well. So, you know, it's definitely, I think that you either need to stay very up to date or you will inevitably fall very, very far behind, because that middle of the road, hey, this is going to be a mid-sized project for us to update is probably the toughest one to justify. So, I tend to err on the former side. So
I like that. So what haven't we covered? I mean, we've covered a lot of things, I guess, you know, you don't know, but at some point testing will be, or what, so Project Beacon. So the code, is there a potential for the code or the company to, you know, who knows what will happen with COVID, but variants may be around for a long time. So presumably the code base is useful in some way.
Yeah, hopefully. It hasn't been part of our objective to build this for the long haul. Though insofar as we do think it's important to build it to be robust and scalable. And so a lot of those things end up going hand in hand. So we have a really great test suite, end-to-end tests that are like Cypress and Selenium, decent unit and integration tests along the way as well. And you know, a good deployment pipeline and CI pipeline there. So those types of things we've spent the time to put into place, so that we can be confident that when you show up at Revere and you've got a QR code to get tested, that it's actually going to work. The long term and the legacy of that is something that we, you know, sort of continue to talk about. We sort of have our hands full with actual, you know, work, but, you know, every month or two, we kind of take stock of that, and it'll be interesting to see what the timeline looks like for this. I think that's partially dependent upon the effectiveness of vaccines against these other variants. We know that the tests that we run can detect these other variants. So it's, you know, certainly during 2021, it'll continue to be important, and Project Beacon will continue to, I'm sure, do a lot of testing throughout the rest of the year. But what things look like in 2022 is tougher to forecast, and you know, we'll have to see what the world looks like as we get closer to it. It would be we certainly all want this to have as lasting an impact as it possibly can, and you know, we're now doing a lot more testing outside of Massachusetts than we ever have before. And so, yeah, there's a world in which this can, you know, be a component in whether it's regionally or nationally or beyond that in the public health infrastructure. And, you know, hopefully we can make a decent contribution to that ecosystem.
Carlton, anything else you want to?
No, I think that's stonking. I love it when we have, you know, I love all, I guess, but I love it when we have a, like, in here's how it goes, hits the real world. That's, you know.
Yeah, and maybe it's, you know, Django seems somewhat common in healthcare. I don't know if that's fair to say, Jackson, but, you know, maybe partly because the maturity of the platform and the needs of health tech are different than, you know, a social media startup.
I think you do find it in healthcare, not uncommonly, I would say. You know, common is a tall bar there.
Yeah.
And it would actually be like a really disparaging comment to say that Django is popular in healthcare, because bad software is really popular in healthcare too. So, you know, I think not uncommon is the way that I would put it. And I think part of that is because of all the great things that we've talked about. Part of it is also just because of the Python ecosystem, right? Like, the Ruby and Node communities have tons of libraries for web development and, you know, sort of the typical tools associated for that. But I just think back to when I was working on Kinsights, community platform for parents of kids with rare and complex diseases. We needed to render out growth charts to help parents just chart their kids' growth. And what do you know? There's a Python library for that, yeah. Right? Like in no other ecosystem do you find that kind of stuff, but because of the scientific and medical research community using Python, you end up having a lot of these crossovers that make your life a little bit easier, a little bit simpler, a little bit more reliable, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel all the time in healthcare. So I think that's a key component there too.
It's like the XKCD import anti-gravity.
So not far off from that in a lot of cases, for sure.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're very busy these days, so I appreciate coming on to share the story.
Really interesting. Awesome.
Can I make a little public benefit pitch at the end?
Oh, yes.
Please, yeah, do it.
So one thing that I didn't talk about, after I left Path AI, just I think this week last year, I joined the U.S. Digital Response, USDR, which is a nonprofit organization that helps staff important technology projects, especially related to COVID and you know, sort of the 2020 world that we're living in. And so I led a team with USDR for 4 or 5 months, had the opportunity to contribute to some really amazing projects, like in New York City, that when they had the PPE crisis and they didn't have enough PPE to go around during the first surge, my team worked with 8 departments across the city to help them get a handle on where PPE existed and where they were sourcing it from, and help them get a handle on what that supply and demand looked like. We also worked on hospital capacity planning in Pennsylvania and outbreaks of COVID at homeless encampments in the Bay Area, in addition to many other projects that USDR worked on that I didn't have a chance to contribute to. So I think that for folks who are looking for who are learning Django and learning Python and wanting to get their feet wet, or folks who have perhaps a gap in their career or looking for something to do in off hours to extend their skills, USDR is a great place to spend that time and make a contribution to efforts across the country that can help with all sorts of culturally, socially, and politically important issues, and a time well spent for anybody who is looking to develop those sorts of things. So strongly encouraged that US Digital Response, check it out.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, but thank you for that. I should ask you, maybe offline, we could probably get someone from there to come on the show and talk about that, but we can do that separately.
Yeah, totally. No, I'm sure they'd love to. So
if anyone wants to help Project Beacon, is there any immediate way to help Project Beacon, or what can someone
Project Beacon is interesting because we're not actually a nonprofit. We just have chartered ourselves to not make a profit, but nobody has put in the paperwork or paid the lawyers to make us a nonprofit. So you technically can't volunteer to work with Project Beacon, for better or for worse. But certainly we are hiring for a lot of roles, technical and non-technical. So if you're in the Massachusetts area, you know, we tend to, or in the New England area, there are definitely roles that that we could use some help on, and we pay actual cash money for that rather than just taking your time. So so if you're interested, definitely happy to talk to good motivated folks. And our partners at Viget are also frequently hiring for more technical roles there, and that applies to anybody at least across the country. Here in the United States. So they're a great shop and do some great work, and you know, would be great to work with folks who join their team as well.
Well, thank you so much. We are at DjangoChat.com, chat Django on Twitter. Thank you again. We'll see everyone next time.
Join us next time.
Good to talk with you guys.
Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.